The Imprint Companion Podcast is, of course, brought to you by Imprint Films. Imprint Films is a brand new Australian boutique Blu-ray label. Check them out for limited edition deluxe Blu-ray releases of long-requested and previously unreleased films. Check out the past and future releases online at imprintfilms.com.au. You can follow Imprint Films on Twitter at imprint_films, or one word, on Instagram at imprintfilms, no space, and finally on the Facebook page at imprintfilms.au.
Welcome to another Imprint Companion, the only podcast on the Australian, that's right, the Antipodes internet about DVD culture. I'm your co-host, Blake Howard, and joining me, as always, is a lord. That's right, bow down to this Australian movie podcasting maestro. He found Drago. He lured the youngest filmmaker of all time, Sidney Ling, out of a mountaintop hiding spot. Ooh. And he's also the co-host himself of the Netflix film Buffett, also Buffet, if you're very French, and one half of the most incredible podcast about reboots. In fact, the only other podcast about movies on the internet, Total Reboot, it's Alexi Toliopoulos. Hello, sir. We are back for a special third episode, a bonus in this month's Imprint batch.
My God, for the Minute Man, Blake Howard, pushing to three eps. That is something very exciting.
And we are here for our third ep for a very special unveiling, a roll of the dice, if you will, as was teased at the end of the last episode. Spine 49, that rhymes, 1974's The Gambler.
You go to class?
No, going hunting.
What?
Cash.
What is it this time? Cockfights?
Bingo.
Did you lose a lot? 1,000? 2,000?
44,000.
You did not. $44,000? How are you gonna get it?
I'll get it.
Starring James Caan, written by James Toback, his screenwriting debut, loosely adapted from a Dostoevsky story about a well-respected professor of literature at New York University who uses writing as a springboard for examining moral and philosophical issues. But when he is not teaching and influencing young minds, he's a hopeless gambling addict, and he is betting with his life. Alexi, tell the people why this damn sexy thing is so worthwhile to see in 1080p.
Let me tell you, Blake, since this was announced as an entry into the Imprint canon of boutique Blu-ray films, I have been so excited to finally talk to you about this movie, because you and I have both grown up worshipping, bowing down to the altar that is the behemoth of cinema, one of the true icons of film, especially in this period of time, which is that new Hollywood era, Mr. James Caan. He is one of my idols. Oh. He is one of the icons of my life. I dreamed of growing up to look like him when I was a teenager. That is true. I thought that if I thought about it enough, my face would begin to look like James Caan when I was about 13 years old. I really did. I was like, if I just think about it, if I just dream about it, I will become tough and mask like James Caan and be just as beautiful as him. And
oh my God,
this is one that I had not seen in a really long time. Probably since like I was in high school and really fell in love with James Caan as like one of my true heroes when it came to like, you know, men in film. And I adore his performance here. Oh. This, I think you said it on the last episode, this is up there with Sonny Corleone. This is up there with Thief, Michael Mann's debut film, which are just two of the finest performances ever in film, ever in the crime genre. And here he does something so special with his character. James Caan truly is a prince in this film. Oh. I think that he embodies like this principle, like this Prince quality. And that's, I always think what he's done the best is channeling like this underground royalty in some way, like this Jewish prince. And what he does here is just some of the most phenomenal acting of his career. And this is truly one of the great films about addiction that I think captures like that reality of it, the way that something like Lost Weekend did with alcoholism in the 1940s, I believe, from Billy Wilder. I think this is, oh man, it's tough to say, but I really do think this might be like the definitive gambling addiction film. As much as Uncut Gems is one of my favorite films of all time, there's something really definitive about James Caan's portrayal here of like the way that addiction captures someone. And then through the translation of Dostoevsky through the aforementioned guy whose name I will not repeat, and then Carol Reyes's directing, where they capture like that true, like the pool of addiction, in that it's not about winning. Sometimes you want to lose because the thrill is bigger. It's hard to go all in on like how great this movie is, but it is a classic for a reason.
It's so weird that the only other movie that I thought about that really truly exhibits that gambling life and the lure of both winning and losing and riding on a good run and then also like almost wanting to squander it all because that's part of it. The other movie that I actually was thinking about was another 1974 Stone Cold classic, California Split, Robert Altman's California Split, starring Elliot Gould, and now the very unfortunately dearly departed George Segal. But when we talk about The Gambler, it's, you're so right about James Caan, is that he's never the king, but the prince, the shitbag prince, is exactly his persona. I mean, the man is in his 80s. He tweets better than half of the internet. This film is such his, I think what is so powerful about it, it's just this mesh of his incongruities. His immense and outlandish talent, as well as his outlandish charm. And when you have this film and this incredible cast, but this film particularly, just him riding his charm and his instincts all the way to just unashamedly whatever his impulse is in that moment, it's incredible. And I just honestly, you know, Paul Savino, Burt Young. Emmett Walsh. Young James Woods is in there, for God's sake. Lauren Hutton. I'm in the minority, but like, I love The Gambler 1974 so much that I like the Marky Mark remake. Like, I love this movie, and like Rupert Wyatt's take on this film is so, it's so much more optimistic about the world and about like actually being able to know, you know, the Kenny Rogers song, like know when to hold him and know when to fold him and kind of walk away. And this movie is like, in that world, it does not exist. Like it does not exist that he will walk away from this. And it's just incredible. It's a phenomenal film. I'm so stoked that it's as part of Imprint. And unlike the theme of this entire month of like making sure that these hidden gems get it, like this in its equivalence to Alfie, as far as influence, as far as impact, getting the treatment that it deserves in this beautiful package is exactly what I would have liked to see. I think the only thing that could have made this better for me personally, being like a gambler head, is like getting the Mark Wahlberg Gambler as well, to like have the full like remake slash inspirational, like, you know, first feature film original treatment. But other than that, just this thing here, when I can look at my shelf and appraise it and see The Godfather, and the you know, that beautiful Paramount collection, Godfather, the Criterion of Thief, and now the Imprint Companion of The Gambler. Oh boy, I am a happy, happy guy.
Imprint, please do everything you can this Christmas to give us a boutique of Elf, the other James Caan classic. That's what we need.
We need it, baby. We absolutely need it. Now, Alexi, we have gushed enough. We're going to quickly hop, skip, and jump into a chat that I am going to have with Matthew Asperger. My friend, thank you for your effusive gush about this movie. It is so well deserved. And thank you for this batch. My friend, in the words of Elaine Benes from Seinfeld, you are completely batch-worthy, baby. Thank you so much.
And it is my pleasure to spin those discs with you, brother.
As promised, ladies and gents, I have Matthew Asperger, an author of Mosby Confidential, Arthur Penn's Night Moves and the Rise of Neo-Noir, and At the End of the Street, In the Shadow, Orson Welles and the City. He is also, of course, the person who has done the commentary track for James Toback's The Gambler, starring Jimmy James Caan. Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us on Imprint Films. I really appreciate it.
No, great to be here.
So I know you're a new Hollywood nut, and this film is kind of steeped in that lore, and it feels like Imprint Films, particularly in the last little bit, have been mining the well of these sort of amazing new Hollywood things as part of their curation. Tell me what attracted to you, or what continues to attract you, firstly, to new Hollywood. And then let's dive into your obsession with movies like The Gambler.
Well, new Hollywood, I guess it's a period in which there was just a lot of opportunity for directors to pursue, I guess, kind of really complicated subject matter. And, you know, it was kind of like a brief period where the Hollywood seemed to mature in terms of its subject matter and its approach to things. So I guess that's why, looking back on that period, you know, the sort of late 60s into through the 70s, there is this really rich body of films. And so it's also the time when many directors emerged, really important directors like Scorsese and Coppola and so on. And Carol Rice, the director of The Gambler, was a Czech-born English director, and he'd made his mark in England in the 60s. So it was also a time where people were coming from different parts of the world to Hollywood to make movies. So yeah, that's, I guess it's just this rich time where studios didn't seem to know what audiences wanted, and there was enough leeway for filmmakers to try new things. And yeah, it worked.
It works so bad that people have been aping these movies or trying to recapture the secret source of new Hollywood for years. And I feel like, you know, personally for me, and I feel like you, with the subject matter that you're so familiar with in your academia and your writings, I just can't get enough of new Hollywood, because it feels like America's self-reflexive moment about like who they are and what it is. And it's the existential crisis that the French New Wave had already had, but it took Vietnam to happen in the States for them to have it. And I feel like it continues to reverberate, like whether it's stylistically or thematically throughout the years. But I mean, people might not be able to immediately sort of pick it out, but you're an Aussie. You're an Aussie that is living in, now in England.
No, I'm in Scotland.
Oh, there's Scotland. Sorry. An Aussie living
never
in...
Never say that to a Scotsman.
sorry.
I'll let you get away with that.
That's right.
I live in Glasgow at the moment.
No. You're living in Glasgow, the lovely former like steel town that it was. Can I ask, where in your life did you start like being able to dive into new Hollywood? Because in Oz, if you know, knowing that you grew up in Oz and went to university here and things like that, was university your gateway to these films as a starting point? Because that was certainly a gateway for me and many people I know, because like university libraries were such a rich resource of VHS tapes and DVDs and things like that that maybe weren't in your local video store.
Well, I definitely used, because I went to Macquarie University.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And as an undergrad, I would go over to the Australian Film Television Radio School Library, which... had this great collection of films that you really couldn't find anywhere else. And so I would go and look in their little viewing booths, and I'd watch all these, you know, European classics and stuff. But as far as New Hollywood, I always kind of had a sort of peripheral awareness of those films, because I would catch certain things on television when I was a kid. I remember seeing movies like Marathon Man, and
yes.
I remember that being, and The Conversation as well, actually. And I'd saw these, like, they were on at, you know, 1 a.m. and I'd watch these films, and there's something about the aesthetic of these films, cinematography, the music, very distinctive, very creepy at times. You know, I found these films really eerie. And so I guess that kind of stuck in the back of my mind, that, okay, that period's really interesting. But when I did go to university, yeah, I really did get exposed to a lot of other filmmakers, a lot of other films. And yeah, in fact, even now I'm still finding, you know, kind of forgotten early 70s films that I suddenly realized, oh wow, this is really interesting. And so it's a huge body of films to dive into. So I guess, yeah, I grew up, you know, where the awareness of 70s films was, you know, Star Wars. So
yes, yes.
But Star Wars is really the dividing point where a very different type of movie, you know, emerged. And the stuff that sort of was pre-Star Wars now is what really fascinates me.
Yeah, look, I couldn't agree more. And it's there's a great podcast, Friends of One Heat Minute Productions, Drew McWeeny and Scott Weinberg. They did the 80s All Over podcast. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to them about, like, some of my favorite episodes are those weird night, like exactly 1980, because there's mm-hmm. still so much 70s energy, and like 80 to 81 yeah. feels like the 80s mm-hmm. itself don't even know what they are yet. There's an identity crisis, and it's the same sort of evolution that happens in the late 70s. You start to see these appearing, like these mm-hmm. prototypical, what people would describe as like 80s movie tentpole blockbusters, and re-educating the American public and what was possible in that realm. Whereas you've still also got these lovely, weird, you know, you have Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back and Indiana Jones's, and you also have Apocalypse Now.
And you have Cutter's Way and films like that, which
Cutter's Way.
It's like the 70s is still kind of going on. And I mean, yeah, these filmmakers who we think of as new Hollywood directors, you know, they didn't stop making films immediately. No. I mean, obviously George Lucas and Spielberg are new Hollywood directors too, but you know, those Friedkin was still making movies, and even Coppola was still making films. So it took a long time, I guess, for the generation who had defined 70s film to kind of drift away from it. And yeah, there's lots of great 80s, 70s films as well.
So now let's talk about The Gambler. Mm-hmm. You've just recently done the commentary track for Imprint. Tell me about this movie, and really tell me about its impact on you, and why you still think, if you do, that it's still having an impact today. Because I think this movie is such a slice of undiluted brilliance that I'm the kind of person who even was so thoroughly enamored by the Mark Wahlberg remake of The Gambler, even though they're doing completely different things, because of, I don't know, there's just some secret sauce in this story and the way that it's told, even though the original is markedly more bleak and true mm-hmm. to the 70s. But tell me about how it impacted you, and how excited you were to kind of be a part of this first time on Blu-ray for The Gambler.
Yeah, I mean, it's a film I've always loved. I saw it, I guess, a long time ago, and but then coming back to relook at it to prepare for the commentary, I also realized how well it fits into the 70s, into that very specific moment.
Yes,
I mean, like so many films of this period, you know, it's a movie about failure, and
yeah.
Maybe that's another thing that's so specific about the 70s is all these films about people failing. And you don't really see that in other periods in Hollywood too much, certainly not today. And this is a film about a very, I guess, severe kind of failure, although the way it's presented is pretty provocative, because I think this is a very existential film. The more I looked at it, the more I sort of realized that the screenwriter, Toback, was basically, I think, trying to sort of dramatize some of the ideas of Norman Mailer about how people really are only alive in an existential way if they're kind of close to oblivion, you know, kind of flirting with the abyss. And that's the only thing that makes us feel alive in the modern world. I don't necessarily agree with that philosophy, but that's, I think, what
Mailer makes it so sexy, though.
He makes it so sexy. Yeah, I mean, that's a huge discussion. This kind of, I mean, it's very much a philosophical idea of its time. But what I think makes this film really work is because the director, Carol Rice, brings a sort of slight objectivity to it. I mean, I think he isn't totally willing to embrace the main character played by James Caan as some paragon of, you know, this is the existential hero. I think he brings a bit more objectivity to it. Which is, I think, the reason why so many of James Toback's other screenplays that he directed don't really work for me as well. But so I think it's just this mixture of collaborators that, you know, they're all kind of at the top of their game. And I think it's so impressive how Carol Rice just fits into the 70s aesthetic, since he was coming from a different film culture. Is coming from British film culture, and he just dives straight into it. He also made another great film in the 70s in Hollywood called Who'll Stop the Rain, based on Dog Soldiers by Robert Stone. So I think those two, they're great. They're a great kind of double feature, actually, because Rice just jumped straight into what was going on in the United States at this time. And very perceptively.
It's so funny that in this particular imprint wave that we're talking about, it's bookended by The Gambler, so this seminal 1974 movie, and 1974, almost one of the best movie years ever.
I'd say 73, but yeah, sure.
It's really splitting hairs in that middle corridor of the 70s, right? Mm-hmm. It's like so hard. There are so many wonderful films. But, you know, it's really interesting that Britain had already gone through this sort of existential quandary moment itself cinematically with something like Alfie, and was so, almost antagonistically, like self-reflexive, like, hey, have a look at how much fun I'm having. Have a look at how much I'm basically lying to you that this is all going to be okay. And you're just sort of watching a person self-destruct in front of you. But obviously, with the greatest level of charm, like Michael Caine, of course, you know, sort of like, and that's, I think, maybe some of the quality that you're talking about with Carl Rice, bringing that objectivity lens to The Gambler, which is like, it is sexy and you're enamored by it and the script and the way that it's written, but it's just, I love how you described it as this like little sort of distance. That just that calculated distance from the subject matter that just makes you pause and go, is this really the best idea? Is this really romantic?
Yeah. I mean, it's not judgmental, really. So it's not condemning this character for being, I mean, he's clearly kind of an asshole. I mean, beyond the fact that he's a gambling addict. That's what struck me about it, is like, this film's really bold because, you know, we see so many addiction narratives about people being dragged down to the abyss by their addictions, whatever they happen to be. And usually we have this redemptive arc, they get out of it. And this one, it doesn't use the addiction as an excuse for his behavior either. I mean, there's other aspects to the character besides the addiction and what that's driving him to. It doesn't necessarily judge him in a positive or a negative way. It kind of just shows this descent. And even though it ends with a very kind of bleak ending, he sort of he looks at himself in the mirror in this kind of triumph, like he's made it to the crazy, you know, area he wants to be. And so it's very bold that it does this. And, you know, I think it really, really works. And, you know, James Caan's performance manages to sell, you know, a character who's very ugly in many ways. And he never stops being compelling.
As people might have heard, Alexi and I talk in the previous episode of Imprint Companion, we discussed that, like, it is really hard for each of us to distinguish a favorite James Caan performance between Michael Mann's Thief, Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather, and The Gambler. Because those three films are just so Caan at the peak of his powers and charm, and they are not necessarily likable none of those characters are necessarily wholly likable. They're extremely complicated, and they've got depth, and they've got rough edges, and they're but nonetheless just extremely committed performances. And I can't get enough of him in this movie. He's just so wonderful. And like, again, it's so weird to say that like James Caan's underrated, but like in the era of the '70s, he kind of like was underrated. And I think a lot of that reappraisal that's happening with the period is going back to his films and going, you know, actually, maybe he was amazing and just never fully got his dues, because it just so happened that he was in, you know, some of the most giant movies as a supporting player, not the leading guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's he was very consistently making movies all through the period. And I mean, I've got to check out, for example, his... I know he did a film of John Updike's Rabbit Run that I've never seen, but he plays a basketball player in that one as well. So, yeah, I mean, he made a lot of movies, and so many of these are being rediscovered. He's... I guess also because he kind of is a movie star, and we do sometimes, you know, he looks like a movie star, and we sometimes overlook the acting qualities of big movie stars. You know, it's easy to appreciate Gene Hackman because he was never a conventional movie star, you know, a tremendously great actor. But so you sometimes have to look at the stars of the period and say, well, actually, yeah, I mean, they were really good actors as well as being, you know, movie stars like Steve McQueen or someone.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope that a stack of people firstly pick up The Gambler, which I don't think is going to be hard for people to do. People have wanted this movie on Blu-ray, and physical media heads who are listening can't wait to get their hands on it. So thank you so much for chatting. If you do appear on another imprint, you know, imparting your wisdom on some other imprint label thing, I'm going to harass you again to be on the show. So this is a preemptive warning. But I do have to ask, because you said that 1973 was a great period. What's another film? Give me another film that we can shout out for our friends at Imprint, that, you know, a 1973 gem that you're like percolating in your head, like, I don't know if there's a good enough Blu-ray restoration, a good enough version of something that's out there. Because I'm always a big fan of like shouting it into the universe if we want it to happen. So is there something from 1973 or 74 that you're like, you know what, Imprint Films, this is what we need to get happening?
I'll have to check if Electra Glide in Blue is on Blu-ray, but that's a bit of slightly obscure biker cop film that I think from 73 that's really good. I mean, Charlie Varick is now out on Blu-ray, so I can't recommend that. That's another one of my favorites. Actually, and I will say, there's a film called The Outfit, which is based on a Richard Stark Parker novel with Robert Duvall and Joe Don Baker. I don't think that's around on Blu-ray, but that's a really underrated, low-budget 70s crime film. Very hard-boiled.
Electric Light and Blue, from what I can see, is available on Blu-ray, I think, as part of the Warner Brothers catalog, so it may be available, but I don't know if The Outfit has a Blu-ray. I'm just going to check it out. If it doesn't, or if it's not readily available, come on, we got to shout it out. It doesn't look like The Outfit, John Flynn, 1973. Consider that out in the universe. Matt, thank you so
much. That's my request.
Where can people find you? Is there places online that people can check out your stuff and find you if they want to interact with you after they hear this chat?
Yeah, sure. I have a website, matthewesburygear.com, and I'm on Twitter. So, I'm out there.
Matt is out there. Thank you so much for being a part of Imprint Companion, Matt. It's a real pleasure to chat to you.
Okay, thanks, Blake. Cheers.